Thanks for listening to Latino USA. Start your day tomorrow with Up First, the morning news podcast from NPR. Apple Podcast reviewer Eve Bethel calls it concise and comprehensive. I listen to Up First every morning on my walk to work. It gives me a great summary of the top news stories to keep my eye on during the day and the upcoming week. Wake up with Up First, tomorrow morning on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Nadia Raymond, in for Maria Hinojosa.
So throughout the summer, I'm a part of a student group here at UVA called Students United.
This is Paola Sanchez Valdez. She's a fourth-year student at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. She talked to us from outside her dorm room at UVA.
Over the summer, we had known about the KKK and white nationalists coming, and we had done a bunch of planning. But the day of, on Saturday, I woke up and I knew I was going to this march, and I knew, not this march, this protest, and I knew that it wasn't going to be easy. It was going to be scary. As a woman of color, it's kind of intimidating, well, very intimidating, to confront white nationalists who you know are not welcoming towards you.
Paola's talking about the Unite the Right rally that happened recently in Charlottesville. That morning, she met up with fellow students and activists.
Other students and I were going to plan how we were going to march from that spot to the actual location where the neo-Nazis were. And we marched. We took out drums. We were shouting chants. Once I got to the park, it was total chaos. We were on the streets marching. I was with other activists, and I just saw a sea of people marching with Confederate flags. Hail Trump! Hail Trump! Hail Trump! Shouting awful mean things, spitting on me and my friends, pushing us, hurting us, hitting us.
Paola says activists of all races and backgrounds were chanting around her.
The white activists and white allies that were there with us wanted to protect the, you know, other activists of color. And there was a point where they actually shielded us. And that was really, really empowering. You know, my heart was racing the whole time. And not because I was, you know, pumped, obviously. I was very nervous. I was scared for my life, honestly. Because never in my life did I expect to be face to face with a Nazi.
There's a debate happening right now about whether the white supremacist imagery and violence that came out of Charlottesville is normal or abnormal for our country. But whether or not it is normal, it definitely doesn't feel welcoming. And that's what we're talking about on today's show. Stories around home and belonging. What happens when the place we call home doesn't feel, well, homey? Coming up, we'll hear about new surveillance technology being used by immigration officers and hear from a Venezuelan reporter about watching her country fall apart from afar. But first, we stay in Charlottesville and hear the story of a young woman who has fought to make the University of Virginia feel like an inclusive and welcoming space. One of the most striking images from Charlottesville is when torch-wielding white nationalists and neo-Nazis were encircling a small group of young student activists on the UVA campus. There's been a lot of reports in the media about the presence of militant anti-fascists on the left, known as Antifa, but a lot of the counter-protesters in Charlottesville were just young university student activists who found themselves thrust in the middle of a major national news story. Paola, who you heard earlier, went there with a fellow student activist named Natalie Romero.
I was with Natalie the whole time. We were chanting beside each other. We hugged each other at one point because obviously it takes a toll on you. It looked like things were, you know, calming down a little bit. The white nationalists were spreading out. And so I decided to leave. Natalie decided to stay behind.
Natalie wanted to check on other friends who were protesting.
And on her way back is when I would receive texts that Natalie was hurt and that she was waiting on an ambulance.
Natalie was going to the protest Saturday. She did not expect the image of her daughter in a Virginia hospital. She said her skull was fractured by the
car. She was one of the 19 people injured during the Unite the Right rally when a car rammed into a crowd of counter-protesters, killing one woman.
Police say Fields used his car to intentionally mow down a crowd of anti-hate demonstrators on Saturday, killing 32-year-old Heather Heyer. Among the 19 people also injured, 20-year-old Natalie Romero, an ROTC student at UVA.
Buenas tardes. Natalie...
2 days after Natalie was hit, Erica Chavez, her mom, sat in a bright yellow and orange room in front of microphones and flashing bulbs in Houston, Texas. She was holding a press conference to talk about her daughter.
She has always been a good student, good friend, good daughter, good sister.
I talked to their chemistry teacher, Susanna Sanders, who said that she was a born leader, who, you know, she was that kid who, when you get a group project, she was the one who was like, all right, everybody, this is what we're going to be doing. Let's make a plan.
This is Andrew Craigie. He's a reporter for the Houston Chronicle.
And her family said that she's on a full scholarship and also does ROTC in college, even though it's not necessarily like she needs it for the money, that she just feels that sense of duty. Natalie Romero's mom, her name is Erica Chavez, said that Natalie called her Friday night and said, you know, I can see these angry guys with torches on campus. And we've all seen the video and photos from the Tiki Torch marches. And then she called her mom again Saturday morning. That's a close family. The mother and daughter talk pretty often. And she said she was walking to the demonstration and her mom told her, you know, please be careful.
And now all I say is just be careful. She was sending me Snapchats and I saw the guns and all that. So I said, just be careful. That's all. And I didn't hear about her from her anymore.
It's not clear exactly where she was in the crowd, but she was one of the 19 people injured when a man plowed his Dodge Charger sedan into the crowd. She suffered a fractured skull as well as pretty severe gashes to her face. There's some wire services that were there. I think it's might be an AP photo. A photographer captured her getting first aid at the scene, and blood is streaming down her face and streaming down her arm, and she's clearly just shocked.
Oh, wow.
And we later identified that was her in the picture, and it was really upsetting. I mean, to be a parent and see that be your child would be pretty alarming.
At the conference, her mom talked about how much her daughter wanted to go to UVA.
She wanted to go there because it was close to D.C., and she wanted to be able to work in the government, always trying to help immigrants.
Natalie worked in a program that helped Latino students get acclimated to life at the university.
Hispanic students that go there, she says that there's only 3% of Hispanics. So she's very proud in helping them. It's really tough. This is...
As she spoke about her daughter, Natalie's mom's eyes welled up. A reporter softly asked how Natalie is doing.
She's doing better. She cannot talk. It's really hard for her to talk.
Paola, who marched with Natalie during the protests, went to see her in the hospital.
She's recovering, but obviously still in a very bad state.
You guys were friends before?
We are actually really good friends. So as you can tell, it's pretty devastating for me.
Unlike Paola, Erica, Natalie's mom, couldn't be at the hospital with her daughter because of money. Their family is low income, and in general, she's been worried about the cost of caring for her daughter.
So her mom is very close and really immediately wanted to be with her daughter, as many parents would. But she said she couldn't afford the travel. Erica Chavez's mother, or Natalie's grandmother, joined her in the hospital in Virginia. Then here, Erica asked for help through a GoFundMe fundraising page to cover medical or transportation or legal expenses. And on Sunday, that page went live and started gathering some attention, and several thousand dollars came in. It had a goal set, pretty ambitious, of $120,000. And I just checked today, Tuesday, and it's just a few hundred, under $150,000.
Oh, wow. So in under a week, it like exceeded its goal?
Right.
What sort of responses were there for the GoFundMe campaign?
You know, you can post notes when you give through GoFundMe. Maybe most remarkable was a woman who identified herself as Natalie Romero Santana, and she donated $50 and wrote, "Seeing we share the same name, the same skin color, and almost the same age is a reminder that we are all in this together. We must raise our voices and fight against this together."
Have you heard from Natalie Romero, not Natalie Romero Santana, but Natalie Romero, the victim, since?
Yeah, we checked in with her mom and said that actually later Monday of last week, I think Monday night, so that's 2.5 days after the crash, that she was released from the hospital.
We reached out to both Natalie and her mom, but neither is speaking to the press right now. A friend of Natalie's told us she's just not up to it yet. Yet despite the injury, Natalie is already back to organizing.
She is the strongest, most bravest girl I've ever met. Even after everything has happened, she is resilient. She continues to want to participate in activism even after this traumatic event. She's just incredible. She's an incredible human being who stands up for other people and who's willing to take a stand.
And what gives you hope?
What gives me hope? Natalie. Natalie gives me hope, and everyone who was out there in the protests, the counter-protests, give me hope. And just seeing people wanting to help gives me hope.
Before ending the press conference, there was one thing Natalie's mom wanted to make clear. She was hoping for a particular response from the current administration.
I don't want President Trump's words. I want actions.
So if you didn't catch that, she said she doesn't want words. She wants actions. Coming up on Latino USA, we look into a project documenting hate crimes happening in the U.S.
This is an ongoing phenomenon, and it is usually everyday people who are doing it. Incidents of hate really happen everywhere.
Plus, how immigration enforcement is upping their game with modern surveillance tools. Stay with us. No te vayas.
We'd like to say a quick thank you and share a message from one of our sponsors, the United States Postal Service. If you're a small business, go ahead and dare to dream big. Because when you ship with USPS, you use the same service that big businesses do. You can come out ahead, just like them. When a small, medium, or large business ships with the United States Postal Service, their business becomes part of USPS. For more information, visit usps.com/tonegocio. USPS. Priority you.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Nadia Raymond, in for Maria Hinojosa. Earlier this year, ProPublica, an independent nonprofit newsroom, launched an online database called Documenting Hate. It's designed to track hate crimes across the country, and it's pretty unique. For a long time, the FBI has been collecting hate crime data, but it's limited, mostly because local police departments are not required to share hate crime data with the FBI. So, for example, in 2015, the number of hate crimes the FBI counted was a little under 6,000.
But the Bureau of Justice Statistics does a survey to try to figure out how many people are victims of hate crimes. And they estimate that there are around 250,000 hate crimes every year in the United States.
That's Rachel Glickhouse from ProPublica. She manages Documenting Hate, and she says the project helps fill in the gaps to get a better sense of how often hate crimes actually happen. Here's how it works. ProPublica has an online form on their website, which also lives on the websites of dozens of news organizations, including ours, LatinoUSA.org, and anyone can fill out this online form to report things like racist intimidation, violence, and harassment. As of now, ProPublica has recorded about 4,000 incidents. We pulled up a few reports and asked staff here to read some of them out loud, and just a heads up, one of them includes a racial slur.
My husband and I rented a home through Airbnb. One of the neighbors came to us and started chasing me out of a beach house because I was a quote-unquote illegal Mexican. I am a U.S. citizen of Colombian descent. She chased me, tried to assault me, and all while calling me racial slurs.
My 13-year-old daughter was in her 7th grade art class when a group of white students took her folder and kept it from her the whole day and returned it vandalized with Trump remarks all over it. My daughter is one of a few black Hispanic kids in her majority white school. The school never notified me.
My husband, a Hispanic male, was jogging along the main highway through town. Two white men pulled up in a rundown truck. It had a Confederate flag as a front license plate. They called him a f***ing spick and threw a glass bottle full of urine at him. It broke on his chest.
Some of these tips, as Rachel calls them, are just that, tips. Others have been verified by the police or by reporters. Many of them, though, still need to be investigated. I sat down with Rachel to learn more about what the database is showing. Are you noticing any particular patterns or some groups being targeted more than others?
So we've seen a couple of different patterns in the tips we've received. The first one, and I think probably the most common thing we see people report to us, verbal harassment or intimidation with the phrase, go back to your country or get out of my country or some variation on those two. We see that over and over again. That language is used by a man who shot and killed an Indian immigrant. And it was also used by the white supremacist who killed two people in Portland in the spring. Another thing we've seen that BuzzFeed has done a lot of reporting on is the use of racist intimidation and harassment in schools. Kids using really racist language and also alluding to certain policies or ideas that Trump has to intimidate other students. So things like saying, build the wall or Trump's going to deport you. That's something we've seen a lot. We've had literally hundreds of tips come in from schools, from both students and teachers and parents.
Because of Charlottesville, I think that a lot of people are really thinking about and looking at white supremacy. But I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about sort of seeing beyond those with torches and sort of just like the everyday incidents that you're seeing through Documenting Hate, or that you're noticing either like set the ground for something like Charlottesville to happen, or, you know, has this been something that has been happening, you know, at this low-key level, so to speak, for so long that Charlottesville is not really a surprise?
We have a couple of reporters who have been tracking the white supremacy movement, and I don't think Charlottesville was a surprise to them. On the other hand, this is an ongoing phenomenon, and it is usually everyday people who are doing it. There have obviously been several high-profile cases of white supremacists who have ultimately committed violence and killed people, like in Portland and in Charleston and in New York, actually, when that white supremacist came up from Baltimore and stabbed a man here. But in many of the cases we see, most of the time, these are just regular people. These are not necessarily white supremacists or white nationalists or neo-Nazis. These are regular people who are causing harm to their fellow Americans because of their beliefs.
So there was one incident recently in North Carolina where a man was arrested for hanging a noose from a tree in his neighbor's yard. Is this type of very in-your-face hate speech more common? And are people sort of feeling more free to do this type of stuff now than they were, let's say, a couple of years ago?
Don't know. That's one of the questions we're trying to figure out is, are people less afraid to share their racist views, essentially? Mm-hmm. And I don't know if we'll get a definitive answer, because like I said, these things have been happening regularly, but just haven't gotten as much attention.
Have you noticed, or have you guys gotten any documentation of people sort of being shamed for speaking Spanish in public, or being told to speak English, or anything related to speaking Spanish in a public setting?
Yes. So Univision actually did a story about this a couple weeks ago. I think it probably also extends to other languages, because off the top of my head, I can think of a couple other incidents involving people speaking other foreign languages and getting someone harassing them as a result. But Spanish being the biggest second language here, we have seen that. And we're keeping an eye on it, especially since we've identified it as a pattern. Anything else we see coming in, we're keeping track of.
Has anything surprised you?
I think one of the things that maybe didn't surprise me, but that I like to share whenever I talk about the project, is that these incidents are not restricted to any geographic area. We see incidents coming in from all over the country, from cities big and small, from rural areas, from big cities, from quote-unquote progressive cities, conservative cities. This is happening everywhere. We've also had a series of stories on racist incidents on public transportation in cities like New York and Boston, which, you know, one would think of as relatively progressive cities. Incidents of hate really happen everywhere.
Well, Rachel, thank you so much for being on Latino USA.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Rachel Glickhouse from ProPublica. To read more about documenting hate, or to tell your story about a hate crime, you can go to latinousa.org. So today we're talking about stories of home and belonging. And when we think of home, we often think of that place where we feel safe and comfortable. For immigrants that are choosing to make the U.S. their new home, part of that means building a sense of security. And this feeling is disappearing for many. We've been reporting a lot here on Latino USA about how immigration enforcement has been ramping up. Detentions, for example, have gone up by about 40% since President Trump took office. But one side of enforcement that we haven't talked about is the use of high-tech surveillance to track immigrants. Someone who knows a lot about this is Alvaro Bedoya. He's the executive director of the Center for Privacy and Technology at Georgetown University. And recently, our host, Maria Hinojosa, sat down to talk with him.
So we met recently, and you basically, you have an opening line that you use with people that you just met.
I think that opening line was Donald Trump is taking the surveillance tools that we developed for the war on terror and using those tools to find and deport immigrants.
You know, I need technology 101. What exactly was this technology developed to be used for in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Sure. Whenever you turn on a cell phone, it emits what some people call here I am signals. And it also looks for cell towers that are nearby. And so in the war on terror in Iraq and Afghanistan, our government and commercial vendors to our government developed this technology that would mimic a cell phone tower so that it would make all the cell phones around it connect to it instead of the cell phone tower. And that way it would be able to figure out who was around the device. And this device was used in the Middle East for years and years. But in the last several years, it started to be used in criminal law enforcement. The reason this is interesting is that this is the first time it was used, that people know it was used in immigration enforcement to catch undocumented people. To be very honest, Maria, this started before Donald Trump. Under Barack Obama, Barack Obama took ICE high tech and he deported a lot of people. He did it using what are called biometrics. And these are tools designed to track and measure immigrants' bodies.
Okay. Actually, I'm going to stop you right there.
Sure.
So to be clear, you're saying that basically Immigration Customs Enforcement started to go high tech under the Obama administration?
Almost. So secure communities began under George W. Bush, and this was a program that shared fingerprints from local and state police with federal immigration enforcement. But Bush never went big on fingerprints, nor did he go big on face recognition. It was under Barack Obama that the secure communities program was expanded dramatically. Immigration enforcement started using mobile fingerprint scanners in the field, you know, stopping people who they thought were undocumented, and sometimes they were right, and sometimes it was just someone who happened to be brown, you know, and who happened to be a worker. And they also actually put out requests to build a face recognition enhanced drone. And in this way, they deported an awful lot of people. But what Donald Trump has done is double down on all of that.
When do your little antenna start going, oh, hold on a second, what is right. it that begins to happen under the Trump administration that makes you kind of stand up and listen?
Yeah. There was a young man in Michigan. His name was Rudy Carcamo Carranza. And this was a young undocumented restaurant worker from El Salvador who made some serious mistakes in his life. He had a DUI. He had a hit and run. I actually don't think anyone was injured in that hit and run, thank God. But he had this record. And he also had two deportation orders to his name. And he was caught and arrested earlier this year. But the thing that caught my ear, Maria, was how he was caught, because he wasn't caught using traditional detective work. He was caught using what people call a stingray, and the actual term is a cell site simulator. This is a technology that secretly tracks telephones from far away.
Okay.
And that was developed for the war on terror.
And so exactly how did this technology, how was it used to catch this young Salvadoran in Michigan?
My understanding is they looked at his social media presence, and I believe that in that on his Facebook page, they found a phone number, and some indication as to where he might be, and they used that information to find him. So once they had that phone number, they went to a court and actually got a warrant to let them use this technology to find him based on that phone number.
That's a lot of resources and a lot of technology to find a guy who, yes, I'm not going to, you know, he had a DUI and he did have a hit and run, though there was no injury, allegedly. But they're using this kind of technology that probably cost, I don't know, millions?
So individual stingrays, you know, will cost several thousands of dollars. But in total, you are looking at millions of dollars in investment in not just stingrays, but also mobile fingerprint scanners, face recognition algorithms, and even face recognition enhanced drones. And that is why people should care, because we develop these tools that don't track our phones, don't track our cars. They track physical beings. They track human beings. And you know, at the end of the day, you can turn your phone off or you can leave it at home. You cannot turn off your face, and you certainly cannot leave that at home.
So what exactly is ICE doing now that's different and that has you concerned?
President Obama's DHS says they want to build face recognition enhanced drones. Under Donald Trump, DHS says we're not going to just use those drones at the border. You know, we're going to use those drones anywhere there is a mission need. He starts using stingrays to catch people like Rudy Carcamo Carranza. Here in Virginia, a prominent immigration attorney reports that he used to occasionally get cases where mobile fingerprint readers were used. Now, every single person who has been detained by ICE his clients has been fingerprint scanned before they were brought into custody. Now, think about that. Historically, people have been fingerprinted after they're arrested.
So your concern is that it's a slippery slope.
It is a steep and slick slope. think about the most notorious surveillance program in our nation's history since J. Edgar Hoover. That's got to be the NSA call records program. This is what made Edward Snowden famous or infamous, whatever you think of him. And this was a program that logged the calls of every single American. Well, a lot of people don't realize that that program was beta tested on immigrants. In the early 1990s, the Drug Enforcement Administration started a program, and they would log every single international call made between the United States and a number of different countries. Most calls made between the United States and Latin America aren't made by drug traffickers. They're made by people like you, people like me, people who may have family somewhere in Latin America. What happened with the NSA is they took that whole legal reasoning and adapted it for the whole American population. And so if you are doubling down and tripling down on face scans, fingerprint scans, eventually those vendors are going to come knocking on the doors, not of ICE, but of local law enforcement. And so, yes, I would anticipate a major expansion in how this technology is being used to find native-born American citizens.
I mean, a lot of times you just kind of come from out of the country, you get your photograph taken by the passport machine. So we understand that there's a kind of surveillance in 2017 that we may have never experienced before. But is there a human cost that you want us to be aware of?
There's a difference between terrorists and undocumented immigrants. And we as a society paid for extraordinarily powerful tools to find terrorists and to find enemy combatants in Iraq and Afghanistan. And now they're being used to find people who are guilty of no crime other than working for a country that will recognize them as laborers, but not as neighbors. By and large, most of the people our country deports have never committed a crime. And yet we are now seeing our own government at the federal and state levels using this powerful technology to find them and to deport them.
Alvaro, thank you so much for your work.
No problem, Maria. Thank you for having me on.
That was Maria Hinojosa interviewing Alvaro Bedoya, Executive Director of the Center for Privacy and Technology at Georgetown University. Coming up on Latino USA.
What we have is amnesia in the United States and across the Americas about what our common history is. And we have amnesia about the contribution of mestizo peoples across the Americas.
Many Latinos have called the U.S. home for generations, yet they're still seen as outsiders. We ask why. Stay with us. No te vayas.
I'm Linda Holmes.
And I'm Stephen Thompson. There's more stuff to watch and read these days than any one person can get to. That's why we make Pop Culture Happy Hour.
Twice a week, we sort through the nonsense, share reactions, and give you the lowdown on what's worth your precious time and what's not. Find Pop Culture Happy Hour on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Latino USA is committed to bringing you narrative journalism that represents the new American mainstream. If you want to support our work, please donate today by going to latinousa.org. Click on the donate button and consider supporting us with a monthly gift. We love hearing from our listeners, like Jennifer Salan, who tweeted, "If it's Saturday a.m., it's time to say damn that Latino USA does good stuff." Another amazing episode happening now. Thanks, Jennifer. If you also love our work, please donate today at latinousa.org. Every penny helps create our award-winning journalism.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Nadia Raymond, in for Maria Hinojosa. Today we've been thinking about what happens when home becomes a place you don't recognize, maybe even a place that doesn't want you. Here in the U.S. right now, we hear a lot of rhetoric that suggests that anyone who isn't white doesn't belong, or somehow deep down, that they aren't a true American. Robert Condavis Undiano has done a lot of thinking about why that's not true. He's a professor of English at the University of Oklahoma, and he's the author of the new book, Mestizos Come Home. He writes that Latinos, specifically mestizos, have been essential to U.S. culture and history far more than we recognize. Our host, Maria Hinojosa, sat down to talk with Robert about his book.
So, R.C., you, first of all, welcome to Latino USA.
Okay, great. Thank you.
It seems like what you're trying to do with your book is to kind of say to Latinos and Latinas, we are part and parcel of this country and always have been.
Oh, absolutely. Latinos need to stop apologizing. There's no question about that. But it's not completely in their power to be accepted in the country. So I really wrote the book for two audiences. I want Latinos to read it and be a little bit proud. But I also wrote the book for non-Latinos. They really need to do some cultural recovery themselves and know our history better and understand the place of Latinos in American culture and stop turning Latinos into the enemy.
So when you say that Latinos and Latinas have to stop apologizing, can you paint a picture of what that looks like?
Well, I think it looks like people caught in kind of a trap where they are from some place, but they don't feel like they're a part of it. And so they're continually explaining their outsider status and acting as though their contributions, you know, haven't been as deep as they, in fact, are. And this isn't really just about the United States. It really goes across Latin America. Latinos, or rather mestizos, are the majority in at least seven countries in Latin America.
Before we get into like a bigger conversation,
yeah,
you need to define the term mestizo.
Mestizo is a mixed race person in the Americas and probably somebody with indigenous heritage, but also European. Currently, if somebody knows the word, it really now is more often used as just meaning mixed race person of North America and Mesoamerica and Latin America. The one term that applies across the whole region is mestizo. Mestiza. It's the most inclusive term.
Is there a vision, RC, that you have that by using the term mestizo, putting it on the cover of your book, you have a vision that mestizo will in fact be something that people in the United States ultimately assume as a title? Because we are all eventually, and many of us in this country are mixed race.
Yeah, I would like that. I think that would be a good thing. But what I have in mind probably doesn't depend on that, though. What we have is amnesia in the United States and across the Americas about what our common history is. And we have amnesia about the contribution of mestizo peoples across the Americas. That's what needs to be done. We need to an act of cultural recovery that includes the history of the Americas, the impact that the people in the Americas who are of a mixed race origin, the impact that they're actually having, that act of cultural recovery, you know, needs to take place.
An act of cultural recovery. What does that look like?
Let me take you back to when I started writing the book. I'm a kind of assimilated Latino. So, you know, I learned Chicano literature, sort of regained Spanish, you know, there was some cultural recovery going on because I was a pretty assimilated Latino, and I read Spanish pretty well, but I'm not really a speaker in any easy sense. And I noticed a huge backlog of what was not known. There was a systematic amnesia about the real history of the Americas, about what the Spanish did. The conquest was devastating for this region of the world. It was like the cultural fabric of the Americas was ripped in a terrible, painful way. And we're still suffering from that post-colonial trauma, really. And people feel it. Latinos live it out in their lives.
So you're basically saying, hello, Latinos and Latinas, Mexican Americans, mestizo. Your presence in this country has been since day one. Your cosmology, right? Your vision of the world has actually impacted American history in really important ways.
Latinos need to hear that. And I thought, I'm going to make this as upfront as I possibly can. The message so often from the culture is Latinos go home, as if there's someplace else for Latinos to go. There isn't. This is home. Mestizos come home here.
In your book, you actually write that the presence of Mexican Americans, quote, helps American culture to become a better version of itself and to move a little closer to being the multicultural, democratic, egalitarian country that America has always aspired to be. So you're basically saying that the presence of Mexican Americans is actually, in many ways, an embodiment of the vision of the United States, because of the fact that we're mixed race, because of the fact that we, you know, have been here through different moments in history. You're basically saying, don't look away from Mexican Americans to understand American history. Look towards Mexican Americans to understand American history.
Well, that's exactly right, and I'm so delighted that Lin-Manuel Miranda with Hamilton is reviving interest in what the founders said. And I think Lin-Manuel is exactly right.
On the field, we've had quite a run. Immigrants, we get the job done.
You know, they were a product of their time. They did not get race. They did not get gender. But this notion of a multicultural democracy was an outrageously high, wonderful goal, that if you come here, your family, you're part of it, and that this could be a country, a nation, that would be continually renewing itself by absorbing new communities into it, and we would value a multicultural democracy. So I think when America sees this, they're going to realize, the country as a whole will realize, it really does have a stake in the success of the Latino community and the Mexican-American community.
But the truth is that right now, that's coming smack up against a current administration that seems to be sending different messages about who can and should be allowed to be in this country, and whether or not multiculturalism as a thought, as an idea, is really what this country is all about.
The founders foresaw this. You read the Federalist Papers, and Madison, at one point, he said, you know, something I really worry about, we've got this multicultural thing, and if this succeeds, wow, this could take off. This could really be powerful. But he said, I really worry that at some point there are going to be some groups, because of their economic power and the political clout that they've got, they're going to say, well, it's our country and it's ours alone. And if you go back through American history, Mexican Americans, for example, have been on the outs a bunch of times, and awful things have happened to the Mexican-American community after the Bracero program, where people started worrying about Mexicans continuing to come across the border. So, you know, I wish this were a recent problem. It really goes deeper than that. I think we've got to get more interested in the history of the Americas, the history of the United States, when we treat these problems as if they just cropped up with Trump. We're giving him far too much credit. And we're making the problem smaller than it really is.
Mexican Americans in the United States have, from day one of their presence, been negotiating how you bring your cultural history, your ancestral history, into a new land and accept what the new land is giving you. And it seems like, again, you're saying, look, mainstream America, you're just beginning to feel this because America's changing, the demographics are changing, you know, the communities where you live in are changing, and you're trying to understand how you're negotiating this. Hey, talk to Mexican Americans, because they've been doing this their whole lives.
No, that's exactly right. And they've been dealing with the failure of America to appreciate them. But at the same time, it's a time where we can finally, if we simply decide to take hold and commit ourselves, we can finally achieve what the country was supposed to be all along.
And from your own writing, it says, as the mainstream culture looks at what Mexican Americans are going through now, they might see what the entire country will be facing in the years to come. RC, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA. We appreciate it.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much, Maria.
The American experiment begins with my friends all scattered to the winds. Lawrence is in South Carolina, redefining bravery. We'll never be free until we end slavery.
Thanks to Robert Condavis Undiano speaking with Maria Hinojosa. His new book is called Mestizos Come Home. Now, to close our episode, what it feels like when your home seems to be falling apart. And we're going to turn away from the U.S. and look at Venezuela. Since January of this year, tens of thousands of Venezuelans have been taking to the streets every day. Most of them are young people in Caracas who are protesting the regime, fed up with the rising crime rates, inflation, and the chronic shortages of food and medicine. In the last two decades, an estimated 2 million Venezuelans left the country, driven by economic and political insecurity. Journalist Ruxandra Guidi was among these exiles. And now, after being in the U.S. for many years, she's looking toward her home country with all kinds of mixed feelings. Here's Ruxandra.
The reporter in me would like to be in Venezuela right now to witness the chaos firsthand, to try to explain it to the rest of the world. This would be difficult and painful. And some days, I watched the news riddled with guilt because I made it out. I have this memory from when I was 13. I sat in front of the TV eating dinner. My mom and I lived in a middle-class suburb of Caracas, and I commuted 2 hours each day to get to school downtown. But in this day, I stayed at home because there were protests and street blockades all over the capital, and schools were closed. Our TV set showed people looting supermarkets. One woman looked into the camera defiantly, like she felt no shame at taking what wasn't hers. She easily hauled off family-sized bags of sugar and rice. There wasn't a single police, National Guard, or any other officer in sight. The looting lasted a full day. And then the shooting started. Quiet at first, but then it quickly became deafening. The National Guard shot at people violating a night curfew. From inside their homes, people shot back. All of it was televised. The riots became known as El Caracazo. From the safety of our apartment in the city's outskirts, I watched horrified. This was not the Caracas I knew. In my Caracas, people went to school, to the office, and on weekends to the beach or the mall. And then we would return home to our daily routines. But as I watched TV that day, the Venezuela I'd known my whole life became a distant and violent stranger. The country on TV belonged to people who lived in the shanty towns that pepper the capital. Places where police wouldn't go. Places middle-class kids like me were warned about. It's been almost 30 years since El Caracazo. What I saw that day led me to become a journalist. The riots shattered my protective bubble as other people's struggles, my family's privilege, and the complicity of people in power collided in my imagination. El Caracazo exposed national race and class divisions in stark ways. It showed me that even a rich oil economy can leave a swath of its people hungry. It showed me that Venezuelans without money or pale skin did not really have the same rights under our Constitution. That was 1989. A year later, my single mom and I left Venezuela. I was 14. We landed at Newark Airport scared about having to start a new life in the U.S., but 1 month gave way to a year, and before I knew it, my new life began to fit me. I made friends and I learned English. In college, I dove into writing, reporting, and traveling. In 2009, I went back as a journalist to cover a move to get rid of term limits. I stood in the middle of a crowd of thousands of people in downtown Caracas, waiting for President Hugo Chavez to arrive. He'd already been in power 10 years. People packed in tightly around me in every direction. About 3 hours passed. More people joined the crowds. And then I saw him, a stocky middle-aged man with a wide smile. He made his way through the throngs atop a pickup truck. Chavez waved his arms wildly, eliciting more adulation from the frenzied crowd. It's difficult to explain how the power of a cult of personality can wash over people and sweep them along. For a brief moment, I too felt carried away. This was not supposed to happen to me, a sensible journalist with a serious skepticism of populist movements. But as someone who'd grown up in a country governed by the rich, in a family that lived comfortably until an economic collapse meant we could barely make rent, I understood the cult of Chavez. He was not a typical elite white politician. He was a brown man from the working class, a revolutionary modeled after Che Guevara. When he was first elected, I welcomed him. Thanks to Chavez, Venezuela became synonymous with soup kitchens and government college scholarships. In the early 2000s, when he first took office, people felt like the country really belonged to them. They left their homes to vote and protest. But then Chavez took our constitution and made it his own, grabbing onto power and not letting go until his death in 2013. I haven't been back to Venezuela since that reporting trip 8 years ago, when I stood outside for hours waiting to see Chavez. Today, I'm watching another version of El Caracazo from afar. Scores of people marching, young people throwing Molotov cocktails at police, people hiding in their homes. I'm watching more than 6,000 miles away, with a screen between us, and with my heart in my throat.
And a big thank you to Ruxandra Guidi for sharing her story with us. And that's it for today. Latino USA is produced by Marlon Bishop, Fernanda Echavarri, Antonia Cerejido, Jeannie Montalvo, Julia Hsu, Zakiya Gibbons, Noam Hassenfeld, and Maggie Freeling. Our senior editor is me, Nadia Raymond. Additional editing this week by Juleka Lantigua Williams. Our engineer and music editor is Cornelius McMoyler, and our production manager is Natalia Fidelholtz. If you enjoyed the music you heard on this episode and you want to learn more, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I am Nadia Raymond, in for our host, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Ciao!
Latino USA is made possible in part by the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. Carnegie Corporation, promoting the advancement of knowledge and understanding. And
the Heising Simons Foundation, unlocking knowledge, opportunity, and possibilities. More at heisingsimons.org.
Thank you. How do I escape this room? Okay.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, a man dies in a U.S. immigrant detention center under unusual circumstances.
I still don't know what to think. Some of these letters say that he did commit suicide and some of these say that he didn't.
Part one of our two-part investigation into the strange death of José de Jesús Denis Sahagún. Next time on Latino USA.